Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Ferguson. I'm Professor of Divinity and Principal of New College and a member of the Gifford Lectureships Committee. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all to this, the sixth and final lecture in the 2018 Gifford Lecture Series from Professor Augustine Fuentes, the Edmund Joyce Professor of Anthropology at the University of Notre Dame. Our format for this final lecture is a little different. Instead of the Q&A session at the end, we will have a brief vote of thanks on behalf of the university, after which you're all invited to join us at the other end of the Playfair Library for a drinks reception. That will give you an opportunity to meet informally with Professor Fuentes and to thank him. And if you have any final questions that you must put to him, I'm sure he'll be willing to hear you at that stage. So that's the plan for this evening. It's good to see so many of you. I thank you for your attendance through the midst of the winter weather. It's now springtime in Edinburgh. Professor Fuentes and his wife have been enjoying our warm sunshine today. And we now look forward to his final lecture, which is entitled, Does Belief Matter? Belief, Hope, and Responsibility. Please welcome Professor Fuentes.
Thank you all for coming to attend this final lecture. This is the highest peak on this planet, and the realities and implications of human belief can, at times, dwarf even it. Belief is the human capacity to imagine, to be creative, to hope and dream, to infuse the world with meanings, and to cast our aspirations far and wide, limited neither by personal experience nor material reality. Believing is a commitment, an investment, a devotion to possibilities. Beliefs permeate neurobiologies, bodies, and ecologies, acting as dynamic agents in evolutionary processes. The human capacity for belief, the specifics of belief, and our diverse belief systems shape, structure, and alter our daily lives, our societies, and the world around us. I stated at the outset of these lectures that belief is the most prominent, promising, and dangerous capacity of the humanity, and have endeavored over the past five lectures to demonstrate how and why this is indeed the case. I titled this last lecture with what seems to be a silly and superficial question. Does belief matter? We all know the answer is yes. But I pose this question here not as a general one, but as one with a specific focus on a time and place, our immediate future. We know belief is central to human evolution and has played a key role in the success of our species. But that very success has brought us to a point in time with potentially catastrophic repercussions for humanity, other species, and the globe. Humans have become possibly the dominant force in global ecosystems, and with such a role comes ethical and practical responsibilities of an importance hitherto unknown to humanity. It is in this context that I ask my question and rephrase it thusly. Can belief matter for the benefit of humans and others in the 21st century? And the answer is complex and not totally clear. But it is my sense that if we cannot more positively engage with belief to increase the good in the world soon, we are in serious trouble. In this final lecture, I'll endeavor to connect key data, themes, and conclusions of the previous five to offer a suite of insights, possibilities, problems, and hopes for the future. I'll offer a summary and a synthesis of previous lectures, focusing on how human evolution, the human niche, and the human capacity for and use of belief are inextricably intertwined. I'll highlight what I think are a few of the most dangerous patterns of belief today, and I will endeavor to convince you that we can work to make belief matter in ways that produce the beneficial outcomes so many of us hope for. But such a path is neither easy nor guaranteed. Nearly 20 years of research into this topic has made me a cautious optimist about the human niche, with its central role for belief, that it continues to hold great promise for the future, a promise that I sincerely hope we get to fulfill. Centuries of scientific research and millennia of philosophical and theological discussions demonstrate that humans have an enormous capacity for what we can think of as a shared reality, a mutuality of cognition, experience, and perception. We are never alone, not even in our own heads, in our own minds. This is the basis for our theory of mind and our monumental capacity for shared intentionality. Shared reality is the basic infrastructure for human communication, for working together, and for belief systems. This shared reality, this mutual shaping for humans, starts with our first breaths, our immersion into community, and is more than the ability to think ourselves into the inner worlds of others. It reflects the core processes of the capacity for belief. In my first lecture, I draw on Terry Eagleton's Gifford lectures, where he nods to Kierkegaard in describing believing as an act of being wholly and completely in love with a concept, an experience, a knowledge. I indicated that believing is a commitment, a devotion to possibilities, which need not be rooted in the daily material reality. Believing can be committing to an unknown or a perception, or it can be a certainty which cannot be seen, grasped, or measured. Believing is completely real, but often without material substance. And it is a capacity that evolved over the last 2 million years in the human lineage. In the second lecture, I suggested that the capacity for belief is not an emergent property or something ephemeral floating above the material reality of the human brain or body. The ability to believe, to imagine, and experience the transcendent is part of the human system in an equivalent manner that fingers are part of our upper limbs. Now, this is not a reductionist assertion. That belief is part of the human process is not the same as stating that beliefs are confined to the material or the functional. Fingers are material, but their impacts and uses are not simply morphological and structural. What fingers combine with hands and minds and the rest of the human body and the human niche to create is often beyond the purely functional, the material, or the tangible. Take Goya's Tres de Mayo. A powerful, encompassing, painful immersion into horrors and humanity. This painting is material, but it draws on and evokes so much more. Goya's fingers are implicated in it, as is every other aspect of the human niche. Fingers and the human hand are part of our arms. I'll give you all a moment to stare at this. These are wonderful illustrations by pictures. These are photos by Guido Daniele. Each of those are hands painted. The material of the limbs has been modified, shaped, and altered over evolutionary time such that their terminal ends contain structures and capacities which enable them to do more than they could without the hand or fingers. Building cars, airplanes, and cities, writing novels, cooking holiday meals, and crafting magnificent works of art, or even fooling us into seeing life. Our capacity for belief is part of the human system akin to this, akin to our hands and fingers. It is an integral part of the human mind and our embodied perceptual experience. The capacity for belief develops from neurobiology, physiology, social cognition, and mental representation, but it is not wholly reducible to these things. Belief acts to extend these processes, enabling them to do more than they could without the capacity for belief. The fact that belief is not always materially quantifiable or dependent on cued representation does not make it any less real or useful for us. But even more so than our hands and fingers, belief has been and can be used for immense, meaningful shaping of the world and ourselves. Religions, economies, political systems, war, peace, devotion, desires, hatred, all are possible because of the human capacity for belief. Belief is a core aspect of the human niche, our Umwelt, and critical to the very process of becoming human. The human niche evolved. And during the process of evolution, the capacity for belief emerged. Let me recap just how this happened in order to remind us of the multi-million-year trajectory that we've covered. Between 2.5 and 3 million years ago, the first evidence for members of our own genus, Homo, show up in the fossil record. They displayed the ancestral primate capacities for incredibly complex social lives, the possibility for an aesthetic sense, and the sensation of awe. Their bodies had hominin patterns of bipedality and specific relations between the morphology, behavior, and intensity of group cohesion that differed from most other primates. These earliest ancestors had inherited the ability to see in stones the potential of a tool and to actively reshape rock into new forms for their benefit, an ability that they cultivated, expanded, and mastered. Our ancestors became immersed in increasingly complex patterns and processes of behavioral and neurobiological plasticity and capacity generated by and generating of the feedback processes between tool-making, foraging, caretaking, compassion, the control of fire, the creation of meaning-laden materials, and ecological expansion of humans across the entire planet. This ongoing dynamic, this human niche, set up the necessary biosocial infrastructure for a capacity for belief. Across the last 300,000 to 400,000 years, material and social complexity ratcheted up, combining more frequent interactions between populations and the appearance of networks of exchange, setting up critical material and demographic infrastructure necessary for the development of particular kinds of ecologies and societies. Here, the human niche developed in such a manner, enabling early belief systems to begin to emerge. In the last 200,000 years or so, material evidence indicates an increase in eventual ubiquity of meaning-making, material and social, infused with a capacity for imagination and innovation. This is seen in the imagining of novel items, representations, materials, and their creation or the modification of other items to be something new. From this pattern emerged the capacity for creating explanations of observable phenomena that were shared and connected to aspects of the material world, but not confined to them, moving humans from being socially complex transactional organisms to organisms who exist simultaneously in both transactional and transcendent realities, and who use imagination and belief to reshape themselves and the world around them. By the time of the advent and elaboration of domestication, humans were ubiquitously using and developing belief and belief systems. Belief systems were growing more complex. The last 15,000 years brought a close to the Pleistocene and initiated the precipice of the Anthropocene. The domestication of plants and animals, the emergence of towns and cities, of communal large-scale architecture, of religious institutions, of large-scale politics and economies, of inequality and of warfare. All of these begin to expand and flourish, reconfiguring the possibilities and patterns of and reasons for belief. During this time, the expansion and solidification of various types of storage, new residential patterns, and new lifeways facilitated new concepts of property, ownership, and identity. These perceptual changes affected the ways in which communities were constructed, structured, interpreted, and lived, such that what it meant to be human in material and experiential forms altered in critical and transformative manners. Differentiation in expectations and perceptions, especially in gendered, political, and economic arenas, expanded and diversified in combination with new economies of scale and content, and created new realities of inequality and novel multi-level political structures. These recent processes in the human niche significantly influenced the ways contemporary humans believe and open the doors for increasingly structured and extensive belief systems. We know a lot about how belief works, so I want to revisit this structure that I offered as, again, a template before we move into belief today and in our future. So how do we believe? And again, lots of words, but very important outline for understanding this process. The developmental processes of the human body and brain evolved as a system that is always in concert with and mutually co-constitutive of the linguistic, socially mediated, and constructed structures, institutions, and beliefs that make up key aspects of the human cultural niche. Humans are constantly becoming. Skills, the way we use our bodies and minds, develop and are incorporated into the human organism through practice and training in a given environment. Skills are always simultaneously biological and cultural and are contingent on the capacities and constraints of the development of our bodies and minds and our relationships with one another and the cultural and material environments in which we are in. Belief is amongst the most prominent of all human skills. Specifically, via neurobiology and the endocrine system, the human learns to orchestrate herself within a cultural context and a range of individual experiences. Cultural concepts and meanings, the elements of belief systems, become embodied neurobiologically, physiologically, cognitively, and experientially, co-shaping our anatomy and behavior, which in turn interfaces with and potentially reshapes the very cultural processes shaping it. The shape of and the boundaries to the human niche, therefore, the system in which we become, are not always material or physiologically perceptible, because the processes and structures of human culture, combined with our particular neurobiological capacity for extensive detached mental representations, create a context where belief and belief systems themselves can act as elements in the construction and modification of the structural parameters of the human niche, materially and perceptually. Let me re-emphasize that. The argument I am making that I think is well supported by the cognitive, neurobiological, archaeological, anthropological literature is that belief and belief systems are evolutionarily relevant in the human. Finally, the human enhanced capacity for detached representations and the complexity and diversity of our cultural milieus enables humans to experience, create, even develop skills in transcendental perceptions and awareness, and to make these a core component of basic human functioning. Developing and deploying the capacity to believe, including the possibility of transcendent experiences, is a central part, a central aspect of becoming human. So inherent in this whole notion of how belief works, in this suite of descriptions of the human processes of belief, is the recognition that cultural constructs, including belief systems, are a specific conviction, a commitment in a given cultural context that is widely shared among members of that cultural group and are thus part of their perceptual and physiological experience, as well as constitutive of the social ecology in which they exist. Therefore, specific beliefs by specific peoples are tangled in human developmental processes and interfaces between the development of our bodies, minds, and societies. Cultural constructs are real for those who hold them and thus matter materially and metaphysically. For humans, what is and what should be are critical components of every human belief system and are, in large part, both contextualized and contingent on where and how we develop and are embedded into who we are and how we become. Thus, an openness to revelation and discovery, however it is experienced, is a core part of the human niche and essential to aspects of our evolutionary processes. But this is not always a good thing. In my description of the evolution and functions of the capacity for belief in humanity, I have highlighted the positive and the hopeful. But from the definition I've delivered and the narrative I have constructed, one can also see the dangers of a species such as us imbued with such a capacity. If you will bear with me for the next 10 or 15 minutes, I would like to delve into three examples that I consider dire examples of how belief matters for the worse. The first centers on a few misleading beliefs about the world and our relationship with it that have created immediate and potentially lethal threats to our species and to others. The second is about how we have created a system of structural inequity so profound that we risk losing sight of any hope of shared justice. And the third, why it may seem smaller in scale, is potentially dire in our abilities to salvage the first two. And that is the abuse of belief systems via specific kinds of fundamentalism and the hubris of scientism, a process that hampers our ability to work together and to move humanity towards better possible outcomes. The first. Today, most humans believe that the world should be exploited. Many societies have various limitations and exceptions on this, and even in some cases, sustainable processes for the use of plants, animals, space, land that they share the planet with. However, most every society, religion, and political and economic entity acts as though they believe that their use of the world is what humans have the right and often the obligation to do. In the 21st century, neoliberal capitalist economic systems have become dominant, populations have increased at a record pace, and the concomitant explosion in the extraction of biotic and abiotic resources across the planet has reached a scale and an impact such that the only way humans could possibly continue at this pace is belief. A belief that the earth can sustain us, regardless of what we do to it. Such a belief is materially incorrect. Most humans believe we have the right to the planet, that we own it. In fact, we often call it our planet, but we rarely share the ownership claim with the millions of other species that are our co-owners, our housemates. Many, if not most humans, also believe that our creativity, technology, and innovation, as it has done so many times in the past, will pull us through any serious global crisis. These beliefs are reinforced by numerous religious, economic, and political ideologies across societies, and they are also deeply flawed. Will Steffen and his colleagues, writing in 2011 about our status in the Anthropocene, tell us, "The human imprint on the global environment has now become so large and active that it rivals some of the great forces of nature in its impact on the functioning of the Earth system." Recently, I participated in a letter signed by over 16,000 scientists from 184 countries entitled "World Scientists Warning to Humanity, a Second Notice." We published this in the journal Bioscience in November 2017. In it, as a group, we identified key global trends in species extinctions, ozone depletion, carbon dioxide emissions, oceanic dead zones, temperature increases, losses of forests, freshwater, and saltwater resources, and human population growth, which taken together portend a looming global catastrophe. I am also co-author of another 2017 article published in the journal Science Advances that focused specifically on our close cousins, the other primates, where we identify every single major extinction threat, population loss, and habitat crisis. And we determine that 100% of the cause in each case happens to be Homo sapiens sapiens, us. Human commitment, investment, and devotion to drawing resources from our planet is not sustainable at our current pace or at our current level of global engagement. Particular beliefs in ourselves and our relations to the world has brought about a pattern of climate change and ecological collapse that may have created a material abyss too deep for humanity and nearly everything else to crawl out of. The second. In addition to the ecological abyss, we have also believed ourselves into a related crater of structural inequity across social, economic, racial, and gender divisions so deep that it appears ready to entomb us. Here in this image, I use the case or cases from the USA, but here in the UK and in most countries of the planet, similar crises exist. The human pace of world shaping and society shaping has outstripped our direct experience with and of that shaping. We're moving so fast that too few of us as individuals, communities, or even nations really recognize the breadth and immensity of the changes that are occurring across our species. We seldom stop to reflect on what we are doing. Today, because of our increasingly global commitments to specific political and economic systems, all of which are based on beliefs about how the world is and how it should be, the distribution of and divisions within human populations of economic and political power are skewed extremely disproportionately. We've developed immense hyper-complex societies and Byzantine political and economic structures that generate massive inequality and disconnection between sections of all societies, creating all sorts of prejudices that keep people apart. Class restrictions, economic discrimination, racism, xenophobia, misogyny, and fear divide societies from inside in increasingly rigid manners. Global conflicts based on interpretations of religious and political doctrines and on social and economic structuring have been present for about 5,000 to 8,000 years at least. But the current scale of differential impact, unequal distribution of resources, and disempowerment is on an entirely new level. These processes are creating differential patterns of structural violence with more lasting and severe inequalities of power, access, and health, and are crushing the possibilities of hope for billions of people. For humans, ecosystems are not just physical realities. Economic systems are not just about the means of production, consumption, and distribution, and political systems are not just about governance. All are beliefs meshed in belief systems, embedded in the perceptual realities and embodied by those within them. For humans, belief, hope, and practice are forever intertwined with ecologies, bodies, and landscapes. Our ideologies matter as agential components in evolutionary processes, and some ideologies have especially toxic implications for our species, and others have disastrous impacts on almost every species on the planet. Not a very cheery overview. But please do not be too bereft, as I will offer shortly a few rays of hope in this regard. However, we do have one more morose segment of this lecture concerning the abuse of belief systems. The third. For my third case study, I turn to what, as a scientist, is especially concerning to me, the fundamentalism in the deployment of scientism as a tool of authority and as a weapon against other belief systems. In my 2017 book, The Creative Spark, I outline how the practices of scientific investigation on one hand and of faith-based ritual and devotion on the other have been mutual components in the human niche for quite some time, longer than most think, and that they can and have enriched one another. However, changes in structural and political contexts, combined with changes in the way in which scientific and religious practice are expressed, has led to a particular range of conflicts between them over the past few centuries, especially around the concepts of the development of organic life via evolutionary processes. This has culminated over the past 50 years or so into a specific set of conflicts that we, and here I'm drawing on the work of many others, can describe as the scientism versus fundamentalism debate. And here, I think both sides of the debate are abusing the human capacity for belief in a similar manner. As a scientist, I focus here on the scientism part and reserve a few words on the end for fundamentalism. In this thinking here, I'm drawing heavily on the work of the anthropologist Jonathan Marks, who has written extensively on the hubris of scientists and the frequent and erroneous assumptions by many scientists that they are working in a value-free, only materially rooted zone of inquiry. Leaving the specifics of the scientific method aside, much of what scientists do, especially when they are working on issues related to life, to human origins, to diversity, to health, and other evolutionary processes, is infused with the beliefs, perceptions, and experiences that the scientists, as humans and members of a society, class, race, gender, etc., bring to everything in their lives. We know this not only because it has been documented extensively by scholars researching this topic, but because, interestingly, very good scientific recent work, both quantitative and qualitative, demonstrate that the outcomes of scientific research in both quality and innovation are improved by having diverse sets of scientists working in collaboration. Diversity of perspective and individual experience reduces what's called confirmation bias, which is a challenge for the sciences, and it helps innovation in applied science. Scientism, the belief that humans doing science are an exception from the human pattern of engaging in and with belief systems, is incorrect. Now we know that scientists bring a specific suite of beliefs, not just about the practice of science itself, to the table when doing their research. This is not a surprise. However, it becomes all the more important when we see certain scientists, particularly prominent ones, deploying what they assert and believe to be scientific position, which in their view is reality, as an argument against religious belief and other belief systems. Of course, there are aspects of many belief systems that are clearly mythical or factually erroneous. For example, religions have developed over time, and most have developed over multiple languages, texts, traditions, societies, shaping and being shaped. They have a history, like all belief systems. For example, as I've said in the last lecture, the earth is not young, and humanity did not literally spring from two parents living in the Garden of Eden. But the vast majority of the faithful in the Abrahamic religions, in this example, do not literally ascribe to either of those two interpretations of aspects of sacred texts. Such details are not the issue here. The real issue is the use of a belief system of scientism to deny the actuality of other belief systems and to denigrate anyone engaging in them. Prominent scientists arguing from this position have claimed that the basic notion of a deity is a delusion, that followers of religious faiths are duped into believing a series of lies about reality for a variety of different reasons. The core argument is that only a version of belief about the world that stems from a specific interpretation of the results of certain scientific research has validity. That science, in their view, gets at the real world, and that other systems of belief offer only illusion. This is a particularly ignorant stance for many reasons, but most importantly, it is one that abuses what we know about the patterns and processes of human belief, and it endangers the ability of diverse belief systems to collaborate, to integrate, to exchange, and to possibly beneficially influence one another, something that we know has been important throughout human history. Fundamentalism can be seen as a strict adherence to specific scriptures, dogmas, or ideologies, and an extreme need to maintain in-group versus out-group distinctions. Fundamentalism demands a purity of thought. in its stark belief about what is real and what is not, scientism is in fact a form of fundamentalism, especially in its extreme version of total antagonism to the possibility of transcendent experiences as outlined in other belief systems as being part of the real human experience. I think any fundamentalism, religious, scientific, political, or economic, is dangerous to humanity. It, by definition, curtails our ability to imagine, to experiment, to innovate, and to entangle with others the very things that have proven again and again in our evolutionary history to offer us the greatest opportunities for success. These are the foundations for the infrastructures for belief, for our capacity for belief. Fundamentalism is an abuse of the human capacity to believe. I use the scientism example here because I am a scientist and because I personally experience it as part of a community of scientists. And therefore, I see the danger it presents to the good that science can do in the world where we engage with others, especially other belief systems. In this vein, and because this is a Gifford lecture, I want to quote directly from Lord Gifford's Deed Foundation for this very lectureship to illustrate my point. The lecturers appointed shall be subjected to no test of any kind and shall not be required to take any oath or to emit or subscribe any declaration of belief or to make any promise of any kind. They may be of any denomination whatever or of no denomination at all. They may be of any religion or way of thinking, or as sometimes said, they may be of no religion, or they may be so-called skeptics or agnostics or free thinkers, provided only that the patrons, and here my thanks goes to the committee, will use diligence to secure that their able, reverent, and here I correct Lord Gifford to people, which is the accurate descriptor here, that they be able, reverent people, true thinkers, sincere lovers of, and earnest inquirers after truth. This is an emphatic call for belief. I use the example of the dangers of scientism in honor of Lord Gifford and the Gifford lecturers before me who offer evidence that the mutual pollinations across belief systems, imaginations, and experiences bring us new and innovative options for the very best of humanity. We have concrete and irrefutable evidence that there is no true egalitarian harmony in the human world, no Garden of Eden in our future, nor was there one in our past, nor should we want one. In so many origin stories, humans are isolated from the world, content in their ignorance of the dangers, injustices, and complexities outside their primal state. But this has never been true. From the earliest glimmerings of humanity, our ancestors sought out, absorbed, and manipulated knowledge. They met the challenges of dealing with one another and with the world via innovative, creative, compassionate, and conflictual manners. Manipulating stone, developing new ways to interact with one another, to forge, to build and maintain bonds, to teach, to learn, to imagine, eventually to believe. Knowing why and how we believe is central to making belief matter in the future. Across the more than 7.5 billion of us today, beliefs and belief systems are complex, often in conflict, and frequently in flux. Today, humanity is too big, too complex, too far down the road of social, political, and economic structuring not to have inequity, inequality, and structural violence as constant components of our societies. That's a given. But we humans still have much to say in how that inequality, that inequity, and those structures of violence are managed, counteracted, and ameliorated. In any possibility of affecting changes in how power, access, and justice are distributed in our societies, belief must play a central role. It is the commitment to a suite of beliefs and the actions that result from such commitments that can redirect our trajectory towards more sustainable and more just outcomes. Creating more just landscapes and relationships across the planet is doable only if we pay attention to the details of why, how, and what we believe. Knowledge and curiosity are and have been centrally active factors in the dynamics of the human niche. Ignorance is never bliss. It is simply the lack of information, and it creates an impediment to human evolution and to social justice. Humans have made it in the world via increasingly complex, creative, and imaginative manipulations, structured, driven, and given life via our beliefs. If we are to make any improvement to the state of humanity and the state of the world, we must do it by creating, nurturing, and developing new projects of caring and commitment, influenced by old projects of caring and commitment. Belief has been, is, and will be our central tool in this task. Let me offer you just a very small story by way of illustration of my point. 20 years ago, I began a project in central Bali, Indonesia, in a village called Padang Tegal, which you may know as Ubud. The project was a collaboration with a focus on interfaces between a few groups of monkeys, a Hindu temple, pictured here, a forest, and local and foreign humans that passed through, visited, and prayed in that forest. When we began, one of our main interlocutors was Pa Achin, Mr. Achin, who was the head of the village council and the de facto manager of the temple complex and forest. Early on, we walked through the forest, and he showed me the challenges they were facing, one of which was the forest was stunted, and new growth had ceased to take hold. There were many reasons put forward by the villagers, priests, other interested parties for why this was the case, but he had a hunch as to the cause. He asked if I, in my role as a scientist, could weigh in. So we did surveys, and our surveys demonstrated that the topsoil was damaged, and that the transition locally from using banana leaves and other biodegradable packaging to the ubiquitous use of plastic has resulted in deposition of a tangle of plastic under the topsoil, killing it and preventing new growth. So when my team passed along our findings, he nodded in affirmation. This had been his hunch. I offered that we could assist in extracting the plastic and adding new topsoil, but that he'd have to create local law prohibiting the use of plastic in and around the temples in the forest to maintain the benefits. He laughed. And he told us that imposing such a ban would not work, as what needs to change before action is belief. If one sincerely believed in the edict, if no one sincerely believed in the edict, then their behavior would be false and would not be sustained. He said that what was really needed was to figure out which deity in the Balinese Hindu pantheon is most clearly the goddess of plastic, one from which they could draw insight to develop and disseminate the necessary knowledge alongside the information from the scientists. A behavior with a rationale enmeshed in a system of belief that made sense and drew on the imagination, creativity, and community at hand. The project worked. Of course, we did not literally invent a goddess of plastic, but did follow Pa Achin's guidance and developed a range of things to make shared information accessible, to make it matter, and to affect change. We know quite a lot about how belief functions in and with our bodies, minds, and societies. We know how belief systems can be dynamic, real, and shared, and how integrating knowledge into such vibrant dynamic systems can be done in ways that might not challenge the core truths for the faithful of diverse belief systems, yet be effective in engaging and promulgating what is good and quite possibly true. Two of the most important belief systems today that need to come together in order to make this happen on a grand scale, the devotion to scientific investigation and the commitment to deep faith in the potential of humanity. Whether you think of these as C.P. Snow's two cultures of science and the humanities, or whether you call this science and religion, it matters little to me. The reality is that the future is dependent on collaboration, mutual investment, and sincere integration between these arenas of belief if we are to have any hope at all. When I was about 7 years old, I lost a tooth. I was told to place it under my pillow and the tooth fairy would come in the night and replace the tooth with a coin. I didn't buy that story for a moment. I was an extremely serious child. So I resolved to stay awake all night and catch my parents in the act of swapping the coin for the tooth, demonstrating my scientific acumen. I remember the hours in the dark waiting faithfully for any noise, any movement. At some point, I reached under the pillow to check on the tooth. But there was no tooth. There was a coin. I vividly remember the jolt of awe and wonder that went through me as strongly tonight as I did then. My whole notion of reality was cracked open, and I spent the rest of the night awake in a kind of transcended fugue. Turns out that I did really fall asleep during my watch, and my parents placed the coin then. But I didn't realize that in the moment. For a short time, I knew I was awake the whole time and that the tooth fairy had come. It was real for me. I believed in a world where there were tooth fairies. Then years later, I did not. But that experience has shaped my science. The deep feeling of belief and the experience of the transcendent has never left me because I am human. It is what we do. This is not a facile statement, and I do not mean in any way to imply that the diverse belief systems around the world, especially those engaging with faith traditions, are akin to a child believing in the tooth fairy. But the capacity, the ability and tendency reflected by what I experienced, the awe, the wonder, the transcendent moment I felt, reflects just one teeny, infinitesimally small part of the ubiquitous human capacity for belief. I use this image from The Little Prince by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry because it is in childhood where we are open to these possibilities, probably more than any other time. This capacity for belief is a capacity that in the current situation we find ourselves, the one that we have created, and must be recognized, appreciated, and developed, and harnessed for change. We have responsibilities as humans. At the outset of these lectures, I argued that believing is a commitment, an investment, a devotion to possibilities, to novel ways of imagining or becoming, none of which need be rooted in the daily material reality, but all of which can be infused with hope. Believing is completely real, but often without material substance. Undergirding and infusing belief is the capacity to imagine, to be creative, to hope and dream, to infuse the world with meanings, and to cast our aspiration far and wide, limited neither by personal experience nor material reality. Belief, for better and for worse, is a deeply and distinctly human process. The development of this capacity is neither accident nor miracle, but it is the product and process of human evolutionary histories and is alive and well in the human niche. Many years ago, the philosopher Simone de Beauvoir told us, one's life has value so long as one attributes value to the life of others by means of love, friendship, indignation, and compassion. I add to this the observation that a majority of the ways in which we do that involve belief. And I hope that at the close of these lectures, you agree and understand that I've focused my efforts on elucidating from an evolutionary perspective why we believe, so that we can all better develop and direct our shared beliefs and actions to imagine, hope for, believe in, and to create a better future. Thank you.
Before we adjourn to the back of the hall, it's my pleasant responsibility on behalf of the university to offer a vote of thanks to Professor Fuentes at the end of this very fine series of Gifford lectures. Triumphing over snow and rain, he has stimulated us to further reflection on the perennial and pressing question of what it is to be human. I ask myself, what might I take away from this series of lectures? Here are some suggestions. Despite the persistent temptation to think otherwise, there is no single defining characteristic or physiological feature or practice that sets us apart from other animals. Attempts to isolate one function or capacity will inevitably lead to distortion. Many of the habits and practices and forms, moreover, that mark our culture were shaped by processes that are already evident hundreds of thousands of years ago in our distant ancestors. Body and mind, society and the physical environment, the individual and the group, nature and nurture, the brain and the body, belief and practice, all these are intertwined and constitutive of one another in an array of complex and reversible causal processes. We must take our bearings from what happened long ago, but he's also taught us that evolution continues. Always it's a work in progress, or maybe even regress. It never reaches a stasis or point of arrival. And as it proceeds, so our world itself is being changed for better or for worse. Within the complex processes that we describe as culture, meaning-making beliefs and even representations of the transcendent are embedded in the ways that Homo sapiens has lived throughout the ages. If this is indeed the case, then it seems that religion is a kind of second nature, not maybe in its large institutional forms, but in diverse practices, beliefs, and patterns of association. This, of course, does not render any particular faith-based claim either true or false, but it does suggest that being religious cannot be easily detached or separated from the ways that humans must live. Tonight, he has reminded us that we cannot and should not live without belief, whether that takes a religious form or not. And these beliefs demand our attention. We must take them seriously, and we must be willing to adjust them from time to time. So these lectures of Professor Fuentes have enabled us to reframe in different ways how we approach our humanness, how we see religion in relation to it, and how we understand the constitutive role of belief in our lives and in our societies. In all these respects, it's hard to imagine a series so readily fulfilling Lord Gifford's intention, of which we've been reminded. The holistic and integrated account of these lectures have displayed an astonishing familiarity with the latest findings of several disciplines. And there's been a great deal to ponder here, and more on which we will be able to reflect when we can read the published form of the materials. But I want to end by thanking Professor Fuentes, not only for the content of these lectures, but for the way in which he has presented them. He has, I think, demonstrated that the public lecture still has a place in our electronic age. And these Gifford lectures are important for our university, not only for bringing together staff and students from across the university, but also for welcoming into our midst many people from around Edinburgh and other parts of Scotland, whom we value as our friends and supporters. I've seldom heard lectures delivered with such zest, clarity, and fluency. He's prepared his material carefully, he's executed it with much elegance, and he's provided for us some very arresting visual images. He's also engaged in these five previous lectures with much grace and insight, the questions and comments that have been offered from you, his audience. This has been a memorable series. We thank Professor Fuentes, Augustine, and his wife Davy for their visit to Edinburgh. We wish them well in their coming days here when they can now relax in our city, and then on their return to Notre Dame, as we've learned to call it. Let us for one last time show our collective appreciation of these Gifford lectures. Thank you.